Welcome to Ryersonian This Week. We have all the news you need to know and stories you'll want to hear, both on campus and in Toronto.
It's Friday, April 12th. I'm Anthony Manrique.
And I'm Zara Hamoud. This week, in our final episode of the podcast for the academic year, we have an interview with local reporter Justin Ling. He's the host of a new true crime podcast diving deep into the Bruce MacArthur murders and the ongoing problem of killings in Toronto's gay community.
Zara and Justin talk about the larger issue of why many of these cases remain unsolved, what the police is and isn't doing, and what needs to come next. Eight men, eight disappearances over the course of 7 years. Now we have some of the answers.
Bruce MacArthur was sentenced to life in prison back in February for eight counts of first-degree murder of the eight men who went missing from Toronto's gay village at Church and Wellesley.
Justin Ling is a local journalist who's been following this case since the early 2010s. His new podcast, called The Village, tells the story of the MacArthur murders, but also explores other unreported murders of people in Toronto's LGBTQ community.
Before we get into our interview with Justin, there's a couple things we discussed in our conversation for which you should have some more context. We reference Projects Houston and PRISM, two missing persons task forces led by Toronto Police. Houston was established in 2012 to respond to questions about the disappearances of three men from the village area, Skandaraj Skanda Navaratnam, Abdul Bazir Faizi, and Majid Hamid Kayan. That investigation ended inconclusively in 2014. The second, Project PRISM, started in 2017 after Andrew Kinsman went missing. I also refer to the 1981 bathhouse raids. On the night of February 5th, 1981, Toronto police raided a local health and recreation spa on Richmond Street. They arrested more than 300 men. This was a cataclysmic event for Toronto's LGBTQ community. It sparked a new period of activism. With that in mind, let's get into the interview. So this is a story many of us have been closely following since MacArthur's arrest back in 2018. And, you know, we know a lot of the details about it. We've been following it very closely. What impact, though, do you hope that the series will have for listeners other than just being an interesting storytelling experience?
Yeah, I mean, when we set out to make this podcast, part of the idea is that we were going to try to lay out the MacArthur case for people who had no idea about it, right? You know, a lot of people in Toronto, you know, are familiar with the case, but there's plenty of people who've never heard of it before or who just aren't familiar with the details. You know, I'm still bumping into people who only know, you know, just the most cursory amount of information about it. And even people who followed it closely, I don't know that they actually have a real good grasp of who the victims were or what the investigation really looked like. So that's part of what we tried to do, was to take this story on in a way that looked very different from the coverage you've seen elsewhere, or at least got into more depth than the coverage you've seen elsewhere. I also didn't want to just tell the MacArthur story again. Part of what I wanted to do was bring something quite new to the table, and you know, the idea behind that was to go back to these cold cases that police had been reopening to look at for a possible connection with MacArthur. And you know, those are stories that haven't been told really at all. You know, there was some coverage in the CBC, some coverage in the National Post, a little bit in the Star, but these stories have not really been looked into in decades, if they were really even looked into, you know, back in the 70s and 80s when they happened. But we're also trying to put together a sort of primer on queer history, including some things that stories have never been told before. So, you know, a lot of this is new. Even if you think you're familiar with some of the stuff, you're probably going to learn a lot from it anyway. And I think part of the idea is just to raise some fundamental questions about how policing works in the city and in this country and kind of anywhere, that will hopefully get people kind of asking those questions more loudly.
True crime content, podcasts, Netflix series, whatnot, are obviously very popular for a lot of people, just that intrigue. But a lot of the times they are told through the stories of the perpetrators. And in this case, you're telling the stories, starting off and kind of prioritizing the stories of the victims. Can you tell me why it's important to tell the story that way?
Yeah, I mean, to be real blunt, I don't like true crime. I don't like, having covered enough crime stories now, I don't like, I don't really like consuming true crime unless there's a really good reason behind it, unless it's getting at something larger, unless it's speaking to an injustice or a policy failure. If it's not doing that, I'm frankly not interested in it. I also had no interest in making a true crime podcast, right? So all of the lenses through which we looked at, you know, how to tell a story, they all came from, you know, the point of view that we need to speak to something larger. We need to either talk about what made these victims vulnerable. We need to talk about what ultimately frustrated the police investigation into this, ultimately what led to these cold cases being going unsolved and in some cases being ignored. I don't think I would have been happy producing something that didn't ask those questions at the very least.
Mm-hmm. So then let's get into that. Why were there so many cases that were just unsolved of gay men or men who were part of the LGBTQ community or the Village community in Toronto? What made you kind of want to dig into that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I first heard about these cold cases, I knew nothing about them. It had never dawned on me that there was this many murders targeting the community, and this specifically this many unsolved cases. And once you start looking at some of the numbers, it really is kind of shocking. I mean, you know, especially kind of the era we really focus on, which is it's mostly 75 to 78. You know, there was upwards of 14 murders of queer people in the city, and about half of them have gone unsolved. That's, you know, pretty shocking. I mean, that sort of spike in violence that really wasn't there before 75 and really wasn't there after 78 is unusual. Like, it is exceptional. You know, my first reaction was that there may well have been a serial killer. I don't know if I'm convinced of that anymore, but those killings were focused on at the time, but in such a way that was not as though you were covering a marginalized community facing violence. It was very much this sort of dismissive attitude, and it sort of lumped these murders in together as though they were almost predictable or expected or almost understandable. This is what gay men do. They go out and they get killed. You know, literally, you heard police chiefs saying that at the time. You heard the chief of one police service in the country basically say that when homosexuals go looking for love or companionship, they end up getting murdered. That's just what happens. And that attitude, I think, was pervasive, and I think it led to a lot of ignorance of these cases, and it led to them not ultimately getting kind of the attention they deserved. On top of that, you know, I know that police really didn't entertain the possibility there may have been a serial killer, and certainly, you know, I don't think there was the organization necessary to put these cases on the front burner because there were just so many other things to worry about. And on top of that, you know, the animosity against the queer community was such that it was hard to look at them as being victims or being targeted because you often saw them as criminals. So there's a whole kind of confluence of issues that led to these cases sort of being overlooked.
Mm-hmm. If you could maybe try and sort of paint a picture through the research that you've done or just kind of your own knowledge of the history of Toronto back in the 70s, late 70s, 80s, going up to the 90s when some of these new cases you're talking about were being investigated. What was it like to be part of that community back then, and how did that reflect in how police viewed things and how the media covered things and how just the sort of underlying systemic thoughts, feelings, systems, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's something we try to get into kind of very thoroughly in the podcast, and you're going to hear a lot about it. You know, if you kind of come into this thinking it's going to be very crime focused, it's actually not. Like a lot of pieces of the podcast are supposed to be kind of explaining these guys' lives, exploring these guys' lives, and exploring kind of the societal issues that went into play in the investigations and kind of policing more generally. It was a bit strange. And talking to people in the late 60s, early 70s represented this liberation for lots of people, especially the queer community. But what you saw was, I think, definitely a drawing back of that, right? So there was sort of a pushback that came against the community, especially in the mid-70s. There was a murder of a young boy on Yonge Street that led to this huge backlash against the community that led to, you know, mass protests, basically demands that gays be either arrested or killed. Like, there was early momentum for human rights protections for queer people in the early 70s that absolutely just fell apart by the mid 70s to the point where every party pointedly refused to run queer candidates. They would not endorse queer rights. They would not talk about any kind of issues pertaining to queer people. You know, when the mayor came out and endorsed a lot of issues around queer liberation, he lost his election to somebody who was backed by the police union. The police union actively campaigned against gay candidates who ran as independents. Police officers regularly arrested people in parks, in bathrooms, in their own homes, in bathhouses.
I was going to say, do you think that all of this sort of pushback could be sort of exemplified by the 1991 bathhouse raids?
I think it was a culmination. It was a part of all of this, but it wasn't the only piece of it. And I mean, you know, even myself, you know, I considered myself pretty, you know, read up on queer history in Canada. And, you know, I didn't know much more beyond the bathhouse raids. You know, I knew bits and pieces here and there, but I didn't know all that much more. Like, I didn't know who the players were. I didn't know what policing looked like before and after. You know, I probably would have told you that after the bathhouse raids, things got better in a lot of ways. And, you know, what I think the podcast tries to do is sort of document what led up to the bathhouse raids. I mean, a lot of the murders we looked at came right before the bathhouse raids. Like, the early sort of frustrations of the gay community culminated in the bathhouse raids, but there was a lot that led into it. And, you know, the protests and opposition that came after the bathhouse raids spoke a lot to public safety. It wasn't just about, you know, let us have bathhouses and bars we can go to, but it was, you know, make sure that we're not getting stabbed or beaten or shot in the streets.
So then in that case, because you're talking about policing a lot, you know, the police have their sort of justifications in terms of why Project Prism and Project Houston were, you know, adequate, or in terms of they tried to do what they could, or all these sorts of things. How do you think the case was handled?
Yeah, it's a tough question, especially given that we don't have the full picture yet, which we will hopefully have. I think it'll be early next year after the external review wraps up. But just based on what I know, given my conversations with the investigators who were on those projects, given the conversations I've had with some other folks from the force and people who have dealt with the cops from the victim side, and, you know, from basically all points of view, the investigators who worked these cases really did their best. I mean, I genuinely believe the cops who were on Project Prism, who were on Project Houston, genuinely wanted this solved and genuinely recognized that something was wrong here. You know, I don't think that they were cavalier or dismissive of this from the beginning. And, you know, by all accounts, they talked to the right people and they asked a lot of the right questions. But all of that doesn't change the fact that Bruce MacArthur was interviewed in 2013 and let go, that he was apprehended in 2016 and he was let go without charge, and that police were consistently saying that there was no serial killer, there was no evidence of foul play, right up until the months before they arrested Bruce MacArthur for initially 2 counts of first-degree murder, you know, eventually for 8. So that disconnect I find really fascinating. I mean, there's a lot of good police work that goes into cases that go unsolved. So why did they go unsolved? Well, you know, are there policies in place that limit what police can do in terms of missing persons cases? Yes, there absolutely was. Was there a lack of conversation happening inside the police service itself around trying to connect and coordinate missing persons investigations? Yes, that's an absolute problem that the police are now remedying that they should have fixed more than a decade ago. Why wasn't the disappearance of Sarush Mahmoodi connected with the initial 3, given that his disappearance happened only a couple of years, only a year after Project Houston was shut down? That's a huge question. You know, why is it that police didn't get the judicial authorizations to search, say, Bruce MacArthur's email or dating profiles? Why didn't they catch him in a lie when he said he didn't know Abdel Basser Faiz? You know, all of these are really kind of detailed kind of questions that are really kind of specific to the case, but, you know, there's a whole bunch of them. And so I guess my point would be, I think it would be almost limiting and self-defeating to just point at the investigators or just the projects, when the reality is it's almost certainly systemic, procedural, and policy issues that override not just this investigation, but every investigation. So I think the community's anger has been to say, how did we get here? What failed us every step of the way? And how can we make sure the next time this happens, we'll have confidence that you won't fail again.
And going off of that, stepping back from this case, and just in terms of how Toronto Police Services deals with marginalized communities, be they the LGBTQ community, be they, you know, racialized communities, that sort of thing, what have you kind of seen and heard that people want to do or kind of want to see change in terms of how their relations with these communities?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, kudos to the Toronto Police for recognizing that they were lacking a missing persons unit. Kudos to them for the provincial government, actually, for recognizing that the legislation needs to change around judicial authorities for missing persons cases. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that you can point at and say, these are good, but these are literally the easiest things. These are the things that people have been pointing to for a decade. These are things that came out of the Picton inquiry in British Columbia after Robert Picton, you know, murdered a number of sex workers. The harder things to deal with are conversations around how do we want to police or not police the sex work community? How do we want to deal with people struggling with addiction? And how can we get them into a place where they are, in treatment, or at least, have stable housing and don't need to worry about, you know, making ends meet? How do we deal with refugee claimants whose claims have been denied, who, you know, effectively go underground and go off the grid? I mean, how can we create a system where, you know, either we're not denying the claims of people who have already been here for so long, or how do we just make sure that they feel safe and comfortable in the city, and even if they're facing possible deportation? All of these are really tough questions, and that there's no easy answer for. But, you know, these are a bunch of the underlying issues that led into this case. And obviously not every sex worker is going to come across a serial killer. Not every refugee claimant is going to, you know, go missing after the claim's denied. But the fact that some did should give us pause about how the system works. I mean, you know, the fact that policing puts sex work communities underground, the fact that drug criminalization pushes drug users kind of into the shadows, like, you know, those are all, there's all ramifications from that.
And then last question, just kind of on a personal note, what has it been like for you to tell these stories?
You know, it's been, I've liked it. You know, I've actually liked being able to kind of bring out these stories in a more meaningful way that I'm not sure others have been able to do thus far, or at least maybe not to the same extent, or at the very least, like contributing to that. For me, it's been fine. Like I've covered a lot of tough cases, a lot of tough stories, and this is certainly one of them. You know, the one thing I will say, it's been hard kind of living in the ecosystem of a story that has gotten so much intense attention, because I know it's been really hard on a lot of the friends and family of the victims, the people who've had to deal with this for 8 years or 5 years or 6 years or whatever. And it's been tough for them. And I know a lot of them, you know, they said it at the trial that their mental health has suffered, that they, you know, no longer can turn on the news, that they're still being inundated with phone calls and emails and in-person visits from journalists, but also just kind of strangers from the internet who think that reading about a story gives them permission to kind of come in and sort of insert themselves in it. So that's been tough. I mean, you know, it's tough being part of the story, even if I'm trying to contribute in a more meaningful way and not, as best I can, make those people's lives worse. But I think I would just say to, you know, I mean, to everyone else kind of, you know, working on the story or working on the next story like this, I mean, take care of yourself, yes, but also realize the impact that your work has on other people. And if you don't, you're only making the problem worse. Mm-hmm.
Justin, thank you so much for sharing. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
That's it for this week's episode of Ryersonian This Week, and our final one of this school year. Thank you for joining us since September as we shared stories with you from our campus and from our city.
Thank you very much indeed. Make sure to pick up a copy of the Ryersonian on newsstands on our campus. Check out our stories online at ryersonian.ca and stay up to date with us on social media at the Ryersonian. Special thanks to Sonia Fata, Lindsay Hanna, and Angela Glover for making this podcast possible every week. I'm Zara Hamoud.
And I'm Anthony Manrique.
Thanks for listening, Ryerson. We'll be back in the fall.
Have a great summer, everyone.